base of her back is fixed at or near a right angle, like a rusted hinge locked in place. Her back muscles are knotted to help bear the weight of the curvature of her spine as she's bent over. Nerves are certainly pinched because of the misaligned vertebrae that she suffers from. It's been nearly 20 years, 18 years, the Bible tells us, regarding this particular woman, that she's been tethered to this deformity. Satan, in fact, has made it impossible through this disease and through sin, not necessarily hers, but the very fact that there's sin in the world and therefore sickness in the world has made it virtually impossible for her to straighten her posture for nearly two decades. She may have been educated. She may have been wealthy. She may have come from a good family. All of that really is worth nothing considering the state that she finds herself in. She could not really look up. It says that she could in no ways raise herself up. Imagine going two decades without being able to see the stars. Two decades without being able to look up and see the blue of the sky or the billowy clouds as they are going by. Never to be able to see the brightness of the sun or a moonlit night. Looking every day only down at the dirty streets and the litter because she would have been bent over so far with no ability at all to stand up. She's only one of several that Jesus healed. Her story is found in Luke 13. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to turn to Luke chapter 13. We're also going to look at a very similar story in Luke chapter 6 about a man who had a withered hand. And even though his story is a little bit shorter and we don't have quite as much said about him, same result in both cases and the same lesson taught in both cases. We want to talk this evening about being touched by lessons about life. And that's about life in general. This is not so much a lesson about the healing specifically of this woman and what it means to have Jesus heal us from our physical infirmities, as much as it is the life's lesson that he taught in that healing and what it is that he really provided to this woman well beyond, and to those around him, well beyond just her physical well-being. Before we read that passage, I want to take just a moment and thank you for the opportunity to be here. It is indeed a blessing to be able to be here. On multiple levels is it a blessing for Judy and myself. This allowed us a trip back to Florida, which is home state originally for us. And that's always good. Great to be able to share in a lectureship with Ralph, who's not only my best friend outside of my wife, who happens to be the gentleman that taught me the gospel of Jesus Christ, for which I am always grateful. That's a great blessing to be able to share in. To be able to be with Brent and April, and they came to one of our marriage retreats just a few years ago and got it down so pat that they haven't had to return again. And it's always good to have couples that do so well at one time. It is good to be here. And I would tell you, really, as much as anything else, if not more, one of the great benefits of being a preacher is getting to meet your extended family that a lot of people don't get that opportunity. We get to travel, we get to meet other congregations, and we don't take that lightly. You are my brothers and sisters, and that means a great deal to me, and it's a great blessing that God affords us to be able to meet our family all across the country, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here so very much. In Luke chapter 13, read with me if you would, just verses 10 through 13 to begin with. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bent over and could in no way raise herself up. But when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said to her, "Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. What a great passage. Even just the start of that passage is a great passage. Imagine now, if you would, this woman who is bent over as we described in the pain. You could just imagine that as years continued to go on in this infirmity, pain would have only gotten worse as she's trying to support her body weight in a fashion that was different than what the body was really intended to do. But in spite of all of that, she takes her seat in the synagogue. She comes in and she sits down, probably even sitting down with great difficulty. As people around her are looking at her, adults may be staring, children, as they will do many times, maybe giggling or pointing at this woman that was so bent over that she couldn't even raise her head really enough to see. And Jesus, who is teaching, stops his teaching, diverts his attention from the text that he's teaching from, and takes that attention and devotes it to the yellow dog-eared pages of her life. Just looking at this woman. And Jesus motions and calls her to come to the front. Did you ever think, just with what difficulty was that accomplished? Just getting her to walk over to where he was. And yet he did that. And Jesus lays his hands on her and he releases that illness from her, that infirmity from her, so that it says she immediately straightened up. And she straightened up and she glorified God. There's a great lesson in there, as well as the passage in Luke chapter 6. If you turn there for just a moment, we'll come back. Keep yourself at Luke 13. We'll come back there. But in Luke chapter 6, a very similar thing happened, except that it's with another person. This time it's a man, and his right hand is withered. We're told in verse 6, it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and the Pharisees watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts and said to the man who had the withered hand, "Arise and stand here." And he arose and stood. And Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath or to do evil? To save life or to destroy?" And when he had looked around at them, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. But they were filled with rage because of what he had done. They were looking for opportunity now to do him harm. When you come back to chapter 13 and you continue in that story on the woman, it's interesting that that you've got this woman who stands up. She's been bent over for almost two decades, and Jesus lays his hands on her and heals her, and she stands up and she praises God for what has happened in her life. And all those around joined in the praise, didn't they? Look at Luke chapter 13 again with me, starting in verse 14. "But the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. And he said to the crowd, 'There are 6 days on which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day.'" I mean, sharply spoken, there are 6 days in which to heal. Why would you have done this thing? Isn't it interesting that she stands up and she praises God? Two cripples Jesus meets. Not the woman in Luke 13 and the man in Luke chapter 6, but the woman in Luke 13 and the ruler of the synagogue in Luke 13. She was physically crippled. He was spiritually and emotionally crippled. He had no understanding of what really mattered in this life. And that's the lesson with tonight's lesson. What was Jesus trying to show by his healings, and even especially his healings on the Sabbath? What was it, just her infirmity that he was interested in, or did Jesus' touch of this person intend to bring about a better lesson, a stronger lesson, a more important life lesson than that? Because not everybody was healed then, not everybody is healed now. But Jesus teaches us something as he touches this woman. Do you ever think about this guy? I mean, shouldn't he have been rubbing his eyes? Shouldn't he have been saying, "Wow, this is incredible. We know this woman. She's been coming for 20 years almost bent over like this, and now she stands up." He should have been standing up and praising God. But he said, "You've broken You've broken our tradition. You've broken our way of thinking. You're not doing things the way that we would do them. This is a breach in protocol. You should have waited and healed on some other day. So instead of rubbing his eyes, he's raising his voice in indignation and rebuking Jesus himself. Did he miss the miracle? Didn't miss the miracle. Saw the miracle, but was focused on the wrong thing. That's what we want to talk about this evening. Three lessons about life that I think show up from this incident, the incident in Luke chapter 6, and then we're also going to have you turn over in a few moments and we're going to read a passage out of John chapter 4, which is not a healing at all. It's an involvement of Jesus with a woman at the well, but I want us to look at an entirely different lesson than all the lessons that are with her. I just want us to look at how misfocused even those that are close to him can become in this life. Jesus is going to rebuke this man for what he had said. The Lord answered him in verse 15 and said, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it?" Isn't that a great question? Jesus said, are you kidding me? I healed this woman and you're going to fault me for healing this woman? Loosing a donkey is somehow acceptable on the Sabbath, but loosing this woman is not? He said, you are so misfocused. You've so missed the point of life itself. And that's what we have to be careful with. It isn't sometimes that we miss the story, or we miss the particular scripture that we're looking at. Do we always grasp the point of life? Jesus always tried to get us to understand there are priorities in life and things that God is most interested in. And we'll see what those are. And so he rebukes him and goes on to say, "So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath?" Jesus said, you just need to, as our youngest son used to say, we might be saying something to him, trying to make a point to him that he didn't agree with, and so he had a standard phrase that he would use, didn't set nearly as well with mom and dad as he thought it would, but as you were talking to him, he'd say, "You might want to rethink that." Well, that doesn't work real well when that's coming from your child. But that's exactly what Jesus is telling this man. He's saying, you need to rethink that. You have absolutely missed the point of life. And I think there's some things that we can pick up from on that. Their theology was so neatly boxed. Everything about their spirituality and their life with God was so much in this physical box that they had themselves in that there was no room for anything else. The violation of the service, there was no room in their service for spontaneity in worship to God. And yet there should have been. The power of God touched this woman and she responded. When we're touched by the power of God, we should see the point and respond to God. We must focus on certain things. We've got to get our eyes looking in the right direction. It is important that we see what God sees when we're looking at whatever it is that He has us looking at. And that's the points we want to make this evening. First, we must focus on people, not prejudices. You think how easy it is to look at the wrong thing. People make assumptions about somebody. People look at somebody and just determine that this woman is, she's just an outcast from society. This man with the withered hand, they were just outcasts from society. Some of the others that we'll talk about this week that Jesus touched, others looked at them, even the most religious people that should have looked at them with unbelievable compassion, that should have devoted their lives to trying to help these kinds of people, just cast them aside. Why? Because they didn't fit the mold. They didn't look the way that they should have looked. I was telling Ralph today, I've got a family member, a niece, who is married now, and the guy that she's married to has tattoos across his knuckles that are prison tattoos. And he's got tattoos in other places as well. And that was the kind of life that he had lived. And he was a rough kind of person, involved in rough kinds of things. I just wonder, who was it that looked at that person and said, you know what? That's a soul that is precious to God, that somebody needs to teach the gospel to. Now, I know in his case, who did? It's the woman that's his wife now. She had been through much of that life, and she had come to realize that God had given her a chance to change her life, and she had changed her life. But when she looked at him, she didn't look at him like we might and look at him with the fear that's associated with that. She looked at him and understood there's somebody that needs to have the gospel of Jesus Christ taught to him. It's so easy to get misfocused in life. Look back in John chapter 4 for just a moment. In John chapter 4, we'll not go through this whole story. We're familiar, many of us are familiar with most of it, I would think. But this is Jesus as he's speaking to a woman at the well in Samaria. You remember it said that Jesus had to go through Samaria. And he's going to go through Samaria. He's going to meet this woman at the well. And we find out that this woman was wrong religiously. This woman was wrong morally. She was of a nationality or a race that the Jews would have absolutely despised as the half-breeds that they would have considered them to be. And so there's no reason, so much so, that when Jesus was speaking to her, she said, "How is it that you, being a Jew, speak to me, a Samaritan woman? How is it that you're even addressing me and talking to me? How is it?" And Jesus had to answer that. I would ask you, if it had been his disciples at the well and Jesus in town, what's the chance she would have been enjoined in conversation at all? What's the chances his disciples would have been in Samaria at all had it not been for Jesus? They wouldn't have even gone that way. But as they have that discussion, he goes through all those wonderful lessons with her, which there's a multitude of great lessons with the discussion with her. But I think really that it is even after that. At this point, it says in verse 27, his disciples came and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" They didn't understand why, but they weren't going to ask. They knew he did some things differently than they did, and they understood that, but they weren't going to ask, "Why is it you're talking to her?" And it goes on to say, "Then the woman left her water pot, went on her way in the city, and said to the men, 'Come and see this man.'" And so in the meantime, we're told a little bit later, Jesus' disciples say to him in verse 31, "Rabbi, eat." And he said to them, "I have food to eat which you do not know." And the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him anything to eat?" And Jesus said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me, and to finish his work. Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes, look into the fields, for they are already white for harvest." He says, "I've sent you for a purpose of taking the gospel to people, and there is a harvest that is absolutely ready to be brought in, and you're not doing it." He says, learn what's important. What were they focused on? Rabbi, eat. You need something to eat. Take care of yourself in this very physical fashion, which takes us exactly toward the next point. As we think about the scribes and the Pharisees, he says, here's what you're interested in. "For you pay tithes of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done." Jesus said, as much as we wrestle with that, you know, it's interesting. I asked my kids in the high school class, the kids I'm teaching in the high school class, "What's the greatest commandment that God ever gave?" And I got from most of them the same response. All of God's commandments are great. We even sing about that, that His commandments are great. And we talk about all His commandments are equal. He expects us to obey all of His commandments. And I agree with that, absolutely. But Jesus was asked that question. He didn't hesitate to answer. He said, "I'll tell you what's the greatest. You love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength." He goes on to say, "You love your neighbors yourself." And on one occasion he says, "Upon these two hang the prophets and the law." It's almost as if you get a picture of an umbrella or some kind of large roof structure that he's saying, here's the structure that everything else is supported by. Every other command he taught, he says, falls under these two in some fashion. There are some things that Jesus said are more important than others. People are important. Eternity is important. He says you need to focus on what is beyond. not on what is in this earth. He says, I know you're hungry. He was hungry, wasn't he? That passage tells us he was tired. Our Lord sat down at the well because he was just worn out. And that's not hard to imagine with his life, is it? Jesus just sitting down at the well and he's worn out. You know he was hungry. You know he was thirsty. He asked this woman, can you please give me some water? I don't have anything to dip this water with. Can you give me something to drink? Oh, he was hungry and he was thirsty. But he hungered and thirsted for his Father's work beyond the food of this world. It didn't mean he wasn't hungry. But it's the exact same thing that caused him to stand strong in the temptation when Satan said, there they are, they're stones. Turn them into bread. Was he hungry? Yes, he was hungry. But he says, I need to think of eternity more than I need to think of this earth. And we need to make sure we're focused the right direction. It is so easy to get focused on things of this world. Sometimes it's money. We know just back in Luke chapter 12, Jesus was prompted to tell a parable because two people were arguing, two brothers, arguing over who was going to share the money from the estate. Tell him to share with me. And Jesus tells a whole parable about that because people get tied to money. I remember talking to Brother Melvin Curry on one occasion. He said he was in a hospital room visiting a man that was dying. He said the man's two sons were in the hospital room with him. They were kind of off into the corner while Brother Curry was sitting over there talking to him and getting ready to have a prayer with the man. He said the man's alive and conscious at that time. But he's near death. But he's alive and conscious. His sons are arguing over who's getting what possessions out of the house in the room while the man is dying in the bed. People get swallowed up by the things of this world. Money's just one of them. God warns us over and over and over again about how easy it is to allow this world and the money of this world to take over your life. But it isn't just the money. Sometimes we think, well, I'm trying to push the money out of my life. But he says, you know, what about other things in life? You know what one of the scarier thoughts is for me when I think about, is it possible that I sometimes get too attached to my family in this world? Is it possible that I can be over-focused on my family and therefore under-focused on God? And I think that it is. He says, you've got to be careful. If you put your brother or sister or mother or father or husband or wife, son or daughter, ahead of me, you've got the wrong focus in life. They are here too. They are a part of this world too. There are good things in this world, gifts that God has given us in this world that are still a part of this world. He says, you just need to understand who it is, where you're from. In Colossians chapter 3, we're told, since then you've been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above where Christ is. Seated at the right hand of God, set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. Happiness has to come because I'm focused on eternity. This world will always let you down, eventually. You cannot take it with you. It isn't permanent, no matter what it is, no matter how good it is. It isn't permanent. I spent about the last, I don't know, probably 6 months or so. I had to get a driver's license back in May. Mine was coming due. Missouri changed their law. Like a lot of the states, Missouri says now you can't get a driver's license renewed without producing a birth certificate. Not normally a greatly difficult thing to do, and I would tell you, even if you don't have a birth certificate, if you were born in some city in the United States, it's easy enough to go to that state and get your birth certificate sent to you again. I was not. I was born in Germany. And born in Germany as a part of a military family, but not born on base at the hospital where my mother was supposed to give birth to me because it was full, and so therefore was born on a German installation off of that base. Then that is complicated by the fact that my mother is 86 years old and she no longer remembers what hospital. I was born at, or not absolutely sure what city it was in. So if you've ever dealt with our federal government trying to get information from them, even if you've got all the information they want, it's not easy. So it took me a long time to get my information together for myself and to finally send it off to them. And they finally got me a birth certificate and sent that to me just in time that I was able to get my driver's license. And that birth certificate, as most people's birth certificate, entitles me to anything that anybody else who is in fact a citizen of the United States of America has. And so I thought that's kind of interesting. So I asked this question, of the high school class, and even asked this of an adult class that I was teaching, because we had people from multiple areas in different countries, and I said, where are you a citizen? And I got different answers. Most of them were, I'm a citizen of the United States of America. A couple other answers, that I was a citizen of this particular country, and they were over here visiting. There was a foreign exchange student that was a citizen of Germany and visiting in the United States. And I said, isn't that interesting? Because if you turn to Philippians chapter 3, Paul said, that just isn't true. Paul said, our citizenship is in heaven. That's where I belong. I'm on the planet Earth with a work visa for God. Look at it that way. I don't know how long the visa is going to last. But he says, this isn't where you live. This is where you are right now, but this is not your home. He says you need to think about eternal things. In other words, that's what I need to talk about to people. It's easy to talk about think in terms of what you talk about to people. All the things that are in your life that are tied directly to this earth. It becomes important that not only I understand, but I share with others that my life is all about the things that are eternal. All about the heavenly things, all about my Lord and all about my God. It doesn't mean I can't tell them about my grandchildren, but even if I'm telling them about my grandchildren, maybe I can tell them about my grandchildren and what a blessing it is that God is allowing me while I'm on this earth to enjoy that time together with them, because I'm going home to be with them someday. He says, focus on eternity, not on those things that are temporal, which are here. C.S. Lewis wrote these words in Mere Christianity. He said, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did the most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this world. Think about that. There's an explanation maybe for sometimes why we're not accomplishing for God what we might be able to accomplish. We've missed a great lesson of life. It isn't about this world. I enjoy life here, and I hope that the Lord allows me to see tomorrow and enjoy time with my wife, and I hope that He allows me to go back and be with my family, but it can't be the priority of my life. We need to truly understand what Paul says. For me to live, if God allows me to live, I've got work to do for Christ, and I want to do that as eagerly as I can. But for me to die is gain. Think about eternity, not earth. Finally, we need to focus on service, not self. It is so easy to make ourselves the one who is on the throne of our own lives. And we do that in so many ways. The marriage seminars that we teach, one of the lessons that I taught early on in one of those marriage seminars, I think is still absolutely true. That I think there are two issues that are the fundamental problem of any marriage problem that may exist. One, ignorance, like any other problem. Sometimes we just don't know. We haven't ever read. Same even spiritually. We haven't read what God wants us to do. But secondly, selfishness. I wish I could tell you, you know what? I just don't battle selfishness. But I know that isn't true, because I know I like me to be comfortable. And I would tell you, so much does the Lord understand that I focus on me, that He says, even in response to my wife, He says, you want to know how to love your wife? Love your wife like you love yourself, Mark. Take care of her the way you're willing to take care of yourself. He says, you know you're going to look after yourself. Look at her that way as well. I had a favorite recliner. Loved that recliner. It was soft. It was big. It was broken in. You know what it's like to have a chair that's just broken in for your body? I mean, it just, you just sit down and it just kind of swallows you up, and it's comfortable. Had that recliner for several years, and just every night, that's where you'd find me sitting, is in that recliner. So much so that those were the days prior to remote controls and televisions. You remember those days? I mean, I know some do, some don't. But I would sit there in the chair and watch 2 hours of television that I didn't want to watch until somebody else passed by the TV. While you're up, would you mind changing the channel? I could sit there parched, in need of water, just to be able to open and close my mouth properly and wait till somebody else got up and say, "Hey, while you're up, can you get me a drink?" Came home from work one day, my recliner was gone. Not because I had asked for it to be gone. It was just gone. I wasn't real happy about it at the time, but I understood the lesson later. My wife was tired of my self-centeredness. How easy it was for me to be in my comfort zone and to think about myself. The disciples, concerned about their own food and even the food of Jesus, but not the soul of this woman. Those Pharisees, so concerned about themselves and their reputation and their power and their status with everybody else and their structure and organization, everything focusing in this way. And here's this woman that's crippled, and they weren't the least concerned about her. Or the man with the withered hand, and they weren't the least concerned about him either. It's easy. It's easy just to get focused on the wrong things in life. And Jesus said, I'm just trying to get you to understand. There is nothing more important than the souls that are walking around us every day in life. They need to be taught. We need to reach them. And Jesus touched a woman, but I think he was trying to help not just the woman. She saw great things and glorified and praised God for what she had received, but how many other lives that were there that should have been touched by Jesus were never touched? I like what one mother said. She was telling her son, she came in and she had a pretty large piece of cake on the table that she was intending to share with the son and her daughter, and the boy had eaten the entire piece of cake. And she said, "Bobby, I can't believe you ate that whole piece of cake. You weren't even thinking about your sister, were you?" He said, "I was thinking about my sister the whole time. I was afraid she was going to come in. I was going to have to share it with her." How easy is that? How easy is that we just really do think about ourselves? We become the focal point of our own lives. Tertullian wrote these words: "He who lives to benefit himself confers on the world a benefit when he dies." I want you to just think about that quote a second. It's not often that somebody would say, "You know what, that guy did the world a favor by dying," but that's exactly what he's saying. If you're a person that is self-focused, if that's what's important to you in life, it says really the world's better off without people like that. Now God would rather have us change and become focused on Him. But it's easy to become focused sometimes on ourselves. Philippians 2 says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interest, but also to the interest of others." He's not saying ignore yourself completely. He's saying you need to make sure you're looking at other people's value as being higher than your own value, esteeming them, putting them in a position to where I understand, so that when I see some soul walking down the street, then I understand there's nothing more important in the Lord's eyes than the soul of that person. And I can't let my prejudices keep me from going to that person. The way that I think. And I can't allow my ties to this world to keep me from doing the Lord's work. I can't allow my selfishness to get in the way of doing what God has asked me to do. He touched a woman and healed her. He touched a man and healed him. But he taught a lesson through that touch to every one of us. I want to read you an obituary that I came across that I thought was very interesting. And then we'll conclude this lesson. I thought this was interesting because we really do sometimes try so hard to live this life and prolong this life and get misfocused. And I thought this obituary said it well. This is the way it read. This was a true obituary as I understand it when it was given to me. He brushed his teeth twice a day. Doctors examined him twice a year. He ate low carb, low fat every day. He gave up his tonsils, his adenoids, his gallbladder, and traded in a few worn-out glands. He golfed, but never more than 18 holes. He believed moderation in all things. He got 8 hours of sleep every night. He slept with the windows open to get plenty of fresh air, carried an umbrella in case of rain, didn't smoke, drink, or chew, or run around with those who do. He drove the speed limit. He jogged and did weight training 5 days a week. He was all set to live to be 100 years old. He is survived by 18 specialists, 3 surgeons, 4 health institutes, and 6 gyms. It isn't this life. It's heaven. And God says if we learn anything in this life and from the touch of that woman, it's make sure we understand how important it is to take everyone we can along with us. To encourage every soul that we can find. Regardless whether they fit the mold or don't. Regardless of whether or not they, in fact, appear to be a good opportunity to teach or not. I'm thankful because I did not fit the picture of the most teachable person. And yet the Lord, through His grace, allowed me to live to hear the gospel so that I could serve Him. And that's a great, great blessing. And I assure you, there are others out there that just need somebody to know that they are as important as Jesus did this woman. Thank you for your attention.